how leftists talk and act today. We're able to point out some areas where they have legitimate complaints, and also help to show that Christianity has better answers to those complaints. In doing so, we've actually sketched, as even if we didn't know it, we've sketched an outline of the theology of Marxism. So it all began in week two with the introduction of the Marxist God history with a capital H. We saw Marxist eschatology as this God changes from primitive communism toward a greater worldwide communism. Eventually, at the end of the world, history will look back and judge those who fostered his advancement versus those who impeded it. So in week three, we saw Marxist metaphysics, which are materialist and anti-realist. There's nothing real but the material world. Ideas aren't real, but they're only self-serving justifications of demons trying to wield power. In week four, we filled out this Marxist demonology as we were introduced to history's greatest enemy, religion, the prince of this world, who blinds the eyes of the people and who energizes and upholds all the other lesser demons of oppression. In week five, we explored Marxist ethics in fighting against religion and his demonic host. The main theater of operation is not in argumentation, but in tactical action. The more practical action is accomplished, the better they can understand good tactics to forward the advancement of history. In week six, we discussed Marxist ontology, or the study of being, as well as theology proper, or the study of history itself. So history is not an unchanging God, but is guided by dialectics, which says all things are held together in a unity, and this unified whole is constantly changing, stemming from internal contradictions that struggle against each other. This progressive struggle moves in fits and starts as gradual change eventually overflows into sudden revolution. Thus, all reality is not fixed, but it's flexible and must be changed toward the end of history. Week seven, we saw Marxist anthropology. So man differs from animals, and that only man is creative within his mind before creating in the world, including his own life as a self-directed project. So religion's current chief minion, capitalism, destroys these attributes by making man work to bring somebody else's vision into reality, and it forces him to work only to satisfy his base needs. This dehumanizes man into an animal, makes him a beast of burden in the service of oppressive demons. Week eight, we saw the Marxist theory of revelation. History doesn't delineate his movements beforehand, so Marxists actively reject presumptuously describing communism or the great utopia. Instead, history reveals his will organically, flowing out of the revolutionary struggle. Therefore, instead of proposing a positive view of the future, Marxist prophets can only criticize those aspects of the current society that don't match the false promises of religion and capitalism. Through this process of criticism, the eyes of the peoples can be opened and history can be released from the chains of religion, and his great liberated future, already contained in the present, can blossom. In week nine, we explored the psychology of those deluded by religion and capitalism. These demons have indeed led to greater subjective happiness in the masses, but Marxists know that these people have been tricked, blinded by the prince of the power of the air, into accepting his false trinkets, his water that will not satisfy. To fight against it through those liberating tools of criticism, man's innermost desires will have to be changed so that he cannot tolerate his current bondage and can be led back to history's embrace. The vanguard of this movement will be ethnic minorities and students within whom history has already placed the guiding spirit of dissatisfaction with the current order. In week 10, we explore the psychology of those who have been enlightened by history. They've been set free to see the danger that religion through capitalism have set around every corner. All of society, all interactions with others, and even all the structure of reality itself is in organized collusion against history and his champions. Therefore, in their holy war, liberating oppression is required to overcome the current demonic oppression. In week 11, we studied the first arm of history's holy vanguard, the ethnic minorities. To expedite their great march forward, they must be taught to shun any commonality with the rest of mankind. but instead to identify primarily within and for their race. Only then can they be sufficiently united to fight against the hordes of religion and capitalism which have been oppressing them. And finally, this week, we study the second vanguard, the students. We will see that although the prince of this world uses all the forces at his disposal to blind them, Marxists say they should not lose heart, because through proper teaching, students can have their eyes opened to the light of the gospel of the liberation of history. And thus, having their eyes opened, they can fight for his glorious future. So today is all about illumination, is all about enlightenment, is all about having your eyes opened either to the Marxist God of history or to the true God. So in thinking about that, why don't we stand and sing about illumination?
Open my eyes that I may see glimpses of truth thou hast for me. Place in my hands the wonderful key that shall unclasp and set me free. Silently now I wait for thee. Let me, my God, thy will to see. Open my eyes and open me, Spirit divine. Open my mind that I may read more of thy love in word and deed. What shall I feel while yet thou dost need? Only for light from thee I plead. Silently now I wait for thee. Ready, my God, thy will to see. Open my eyes, illumine me, Spirit divine. Open my way that I may bring trophies of grace to Christ my King. Echoed in love, thy word shall outring, sweet as the note that angels sing. Silently now I wait for thee. Ready, my God, thy will to see. Open my eyes, illumine me, Spirit divine.
Father God, we thank you for all of your good and precious gifts, and we thank you for the illumination that only you can provide, Lord. We know that we humans are born blind to spiritual things, and that it's only by your Spirit that we can be made to see. Lord, help us to study the way that this world sees illumination. Help us to be able to understand it and to be able to see what they talk about. But Lord, help us even more so to use that knowledge to bring them the truth of the gospel, the true illumination. Lord, help us to do all these things in your name. Amen. You may be seated. So obviously, in talking about illumination, part of scripture that we're going to keep in our mind today, I'm going to read from 1 Corinthians 4, 1 through 6. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart, but we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word, but by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. This is the word of the Lord. So keeping those things in mind, the first person that we're going to be reading from is our good friend Marcus, who we've seen the past couple of weeks. And he starts, "This means that previously neutral, value-free, formal aspects of learning and teaching now become, on their own grounds and in their own right, political." So in other words, there's no such thing as value-free learning or teaching. Politics isn't everything. So as we saw in week 3, all ideologies, including that of liberal neutrality, only serve to justify the rulers holding on to power. So why do kids need to be taught constantly how terrible America is? Because otherwise they would learn patriotism by osmosis, hindering the revolution. If we try to teach neutral or formal lessons, even if we weren't meaning to, they would teach the values of the current corrupt system. So the only other alternative, he's going to go on to say, is to consciously teach subversion of the current system towards a newer, better way of life. In any case, learning to know the facts, the whole truth, and to comprehend it is radical criticism throughout, intellectual subversion. In a world in which the human faculties and needs are arrested or perverted, autonomous or self-law thinking leads to a perverted world, contradiction and counter-image of the established world of repression. So as we saw in week 7, humans are only actually truly human when they're autonomous, when they have self-law, they self-direct their work toward their own vision, self-direct their life as its own project. So instead of trying to fit into this repressive world, that would include people like the counterculture hippies, the free love people, gay pride, drag queen story hour. So why does the media and the left love all these degenerate weirdos? Because they're the people who aren't ruled by society, but instead become fully human by self-directing their own activities in spite of the man trying to keep them down. Going back to Marcuse, "And this contradiction is not simply stipulated, is not simply the product of confused thinking or fantasy, but is the logical development of the given, the existing world, to the degree to which this development is actually impeded by the sheer weight of a repressive society and the necessity of making a living in it. Repression invades the academic enterprise itself, even prior to all restrictions on academic freedom." So even if there were no laws against drag queen story hour, for instance, the goal of having students sit in school and to teach them to make a living, teach them to be successful in the current world, serves to uphold the current society. So instead, as we saw in week 9, mankind's innermost desires will have to be changed so that he can't survive in the competitive capitalist society, but will have the biologic desire for socialism. So why can't our children read and write, but they're fantastic at socialist critique of society? Because that's now the point of school. The pre-emptying of the mind vitiates impartiality and objectivity. So this focus on being able to succeed makes one less likely to fight for the impartial or the objective good of Marxist revolution. Unless the student learns to think in the opposite direction, he will be inclined to place the facts into the predominant framework of values. So unless school serves as an indoctrination into Marxist criticism, the students will absorb the values of the current society so that they can get ahead and actually succeed in the current society. Scholarship, i.e. the acquisition and communication of knowledge, prohibits the purification and isolation of facts from the context of the whole truth. So as we saw in week 6, the truth can only be understood holistically, systematically, all at once. Here the truth is understood in the holistic context where everything in society works for the powerful, to keep their power. So how can black cops killing a black suspect in Memphis be a form of white supremacy? Well, because seen holistically, that and all other form of policing serve to uphold this current system. And the current system they call white supremacy. An essential part of the latter is recognition of the frightening extent to which history was made and recorded by and for the victors. That is, the extent to which history was the development of oppression. And this oppression is in the facts themselves, which it establishes. Thus, they themselves carry a negative value as part of the aspect of their facticity. So as we saw in week 10, Marxists speak as those under the judgment of God, seeing danger around every corner. In this case, what society considers facts themselves, these supposed neutral things, things that are taught to children, are in reality infected by the oppressive designs of the powerful in order to keep up their own power. So why can't we just teach the facts about history or facts about slavery? Why do we need the 1619 Project? Because if left to their own devices, children would be infected by the negative values of facts that were written by the victors and wouldn't use it to overthrow the system. To treat the Great Crusades against humanity like that against the Albigensians with the same impartiality as the desperate struggle for humanity means neutralizing their opposite historical function, reconciling the executioners with their victims, distorting the record. As we saw in week 2, Marxists think they know the overall course of history from primitive communism through historical development toward a glorious worldwide communist utopia. So why are things like the Cuban Revolution taught with unbridled enthusiasm, while movements in the opposite direction, like the Reagan Revolution, are lamented with visceral hatred? Well, because Castro worked toward the fulfillment of history, while Reagan worked against it. Such spurious neutrality serves to reproduce acceptance of the dominion of the victors in the consciousness of man. Here too, in the education of those who are not yet maturely integrated, so of those who have not yet been brainwashed by capitalism, in the mind of the young, the ground for liberating tolerance is still to be created. So only the young are still malleable enough to create illumination, the liberating tolerance or radical enlightenment or true consciousness on a large scale. Any thoughts about that one? All right, so going on to Freire. So if you don't remember him, he is the guy from Brazil. He's the head, basically, teacher of theory of teaching in Brazil. But he didn't stay in Brazil. Right now, the third most cited work in all of social sciences is right what we're reading from, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. So this has infected and taken over all of our schools. So this book, he starts out the work, this book will present some aspects of what the writer has termed the pedagogy, which pedagogy is theory of teaching, the pedagogy of the oppressed. A pedagogy which must be forged with, not for, the oppressed, whether individuals or people, in the incessant struggle to regain their humanity. So we must not teach children, but learn from them how best to regain their humanity, which we saw in week 7 was lost by oppression in the capitalist system, by systemic oppression, making them produce the vision of others. Because of this, as we saw in week 8, Marxist educators can't have a vision of the utopia and force it on the children, because that would turn them into reactionaries, doing the same thing as the oppressors. So instead, this pedagogy must be forged with, not for, the students. The students also have to instruct the teachers how to end their oppression. So why is there so much whining and complaining and focusing on students' feelings in school? Well, this pedagogy makes oppression and its causes objects of reflection by the oppressed. So we constantly have to point out to children how they are oppressed and that they are oppressed because of the entire capitalist system. And from that reflection will come their necessary engagement in the struggle for their liberation. So this reflection will cause them to engage in political action. And in the struggle, this pedagogy will be made and remade, because future children will find even more and different things that make them oppressed. The central problem is this: how can the oppressed, as divided, unauthentic beings, participate in developing the pedagogy of their liberation, since they're just dumb kids? Only as they discover themselves to be hosts of the oppressor can they contribute to the midwifery of their liberating pedagogy. So since they live in a white supremacist, patriarchal, cis-heteronormative world, there will inevitably be white supremacy within them. It just takes a teacher, or it takes an expert, to identify it in the children and help them to expunge it. As long as they live in the duality in which to be is to be like, and to be like is to be like the oppressor, this contribution is impossible. So as long as children strive to be normal and fit into society, this liberation can't happen. The pedagogy of the oppressed is an instrument for their critical discovery that both they and their oppressors are manifestations of dehumanization. So the entire goal of his theory of teaching is to lead to critical discovery, or illumination, or liberating tolerance, or radical enlightenment, or any of the other words that they want to use for that. It's illumination into the Marxist cult. Yeah.
Did you show the word host there? Mm-hmm. Is that like they have gathered a following of people, so they are teaching people about these newfound freedoms, so they're hosting an enlightenment party?
Yes.
Or are they hosts, like in the biological?
Yeah, it's
being fed upon.
Right. So it's the parasite host duality. So the parasite is the current values of this society, and they're hosts of that. So
they're being taught that they're being eaten alive.
Correct.
Without
the newfound illumination. So liberation is thus a childbirth, and a painful one. The man or woman who emerges is a new person, viable only as the oppressor-oppressed contradiction is superseded by the humanization of all people. So this new person, as we saw before in Marcuse, is not even viable in the current society. He or she can't succeed, can't thrive. They have been interjected with the biological need of socialism, and therefore are pathologically unable to survive in the competitive capitalist society. So why all of our safe spaces and speech codes and words as violent trauma? This. Or to put it another way, the solution of this contradiction is born in the labor which brings it into the world, this new being, no longer oppressor nor oppressed, but human in the process of achieving freedom. So just as humans have been made which are pathologically unable to survive within this current society, so a society that contains a critical mass of such pathological humans will itself be unable to succeed and will need to transform into the freedom of socialism. This solution cannot be achieved in idealistic terms, because as we saw in week 3, the guiding light of Marxism is materialism. There is no reality in ideas, no eternal truths, no philosophical limits that can't be crossed. In order for the oppressed to be able to wage the struggle for their liberation, they must perceive the reality of oppression not as a closed world from which there is no exit, but as a limiting situation which they can transform. So they can't be taught that reality simply exists the way that it does and that they must mold themselves to fit within its structures. Instead, anything must be possible. Your gender is an unchosen prism, but you can change your gender. Your unplanned pregnancy is an unchosen prism, but you can get an abortion so that childbirth doesn't naturally follow sex. Reality is infinitely malleable to fit whatever you want it to be. This perception is a necessary, but not a sufficient condition for liberation. It must become the motivating force for liberating action, So as we saw in week 5, since history is really only changed by material factors and ideas spontaneously follow afterwards, the main realm of revolutionary struggle is not in argumentation or ideas, but in revolutionary tactical action. So it's not enough to argue against the underage transgender policy in Tennessee. There must be tactical action to further the revolution. And as Marcuse said above, only children can be fully indoctrinated into the Marxist cult. So the school system is the main fount of the revolution. Therefore, any school working to uphold traditional Western values must be destroyed. Nor does the discovery by the oppressed that they exist in a dialectical relationship to the oppressor as his antithesis, that without them the oppressor could not exist, in itself constitute liberation. The oppressed can overcome the contradiction in which they are caught only when this perception enlists them in the struggle to free themselves. So just knowing that the oppressors rigged the system to keep themselves in power isn't enough. Only through practical struggle, including violent struggle, can liberation succeed. The same is true with respect to the individual oppressor as a person. Discovering himself to be an oppressor may cause considerable anguish, but it does not necessarily lead to solidarity with the oppressed. So you can woke-wash yourself by doing your due penance, but yet not really have solidarity because you're not actively forwarding the revolution. Rationalizing his guilt through paternalistic treatment of the oppressed, all while holding them fast in a position of dependence, will not do. So yeah, you certainly can't try to make their lives better by teaching them how to fit in, to get a job, take initiative, become self-sufficient. I mean, that's obviously off the table. But you can't even try to make their lives better by offering charity within the current system, because that holds them in a position of dependence on the oppressive system. Solidarity requires that one enter into the situation of those with whom one is solidary. It is a radical posture. The oppressor is solidary with the oppressed only when he stops regarding the oppressed as an abstract category and sees them as persons who have been unjustly dealt with, deprived of a voice, cheated in the sale of their labor, when he stops making pious, sentimental, and individualistic gestures and risks an act of love, like engaging in the summer of love, taking over entire sections of American cities in order to overthrow the system. True solidarity is found only in the plenitude of this act of love, in its existentiality, in its praxis. So again, praxis is a practical, a revolutionary action. To affirm that men and women are persons and as persons should be free, and yet to do nothing tangible to make this affirmation a reality, is a farce. So only practical, tactical action to advance the revolution matters. So viva la revolution! Thus says the chief philosophy of pedagogy to our children. What does everyone think? Makes you laugh cause so you don't cry?
Yeah.
So, makes you laugh so you don't cry?
No, well, it's just, you know, as I've seen some of these people go through that, those start embracing this stuff and they finally grow up, they get a job, and they go from these liberal socialists to now, some of them are big conservatives, even to the point where they are backing Trump. The quantum metamorphosis of the world. Was I just stupid to begin with, or was I ahead of the curve? Those who thought right from the beginning it was all silly stuff. It was fun or laughable to watch it take place. Some people, I know through some die hard, they'll never change. But,
it's hard to get people out of a cult.
When you go read this stuff, it recalls teachers you had in high school, that you're aware of now, that they were kind of pushing this stuff in, you know, but not overtly, but we're so, people like myself were so busy in high school doing other stuff that they really didn't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
I want to look at that last paragraph, verse 2, where it says, the oppressor of solidarity with the oppression only when he stops regarding the oppressed as an abstract category.
Mm-hmm.
Full circle contradictory, because he started out by making sure everybody was in a category,
right?
Were the oppressed or the non-oppressed, or mm-hmm. were the oppressed or the oppressors, and now he says, you really have to treat people as not categories. Well, that's the Christian position, too, that we don't care if they're black or white, rich or poor, we want to serve them, we want to love them. So, I mean, this is a parallel outworking in the Christian faith towards mm-hmm. virtue, and, but his argumentation,
it doesn't follow. Yeah,
what the, because we would say the same thing. We don't look at people as a category. We look at them as a human being. They need love.
Okay. Yeah,
so
I would
you
agree.
See him as contradictory there, or no?
Yes. Right. He. In his own like unconscious, in his own mind, he thinks that he's not contradicting himself, because the only way to deal with somebody as a person is to free them by this you know Marxist revolution. So, which doesn't follow, because then you're still acting like he's a category.
Yeah.
In his mind, he doesn't think that. But yeah, I mean, I would agree.
Anyway, the only other comment that I have, you know, your opening monologue, you know, you published that somewhere. Okay. Really? I mean, that was just those topics, whether it's psychology, housing.
Well, thank you.
It's like I'm sitting in the theater of the absurd, because these people teach that ideas are not the foundation
right.
of materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you've got this whole thing, which is an idea.
Yet they write lots and lots of books.
They come up with this. They have this whole theology
mm-hmm.
that's come out of their mind. And they're teaching against ideas. So
yep.
It's like, it's absurd.
Lots of modern things are absurd. So you have the postmodernists that say that you can't, that language doesn't mean anything. And they'll write 100 books to teach you that language doesn't mean anything.
So words are violence.
I was reading an article about Gwyneth Paltrow
mm-hmm.
and her sued
okay.
by an optometrist who said she crashed into him on a ski slope and somehow
okay.
damaged him, so they couldn't their functions. And so they went to court to fight this out. And Gwyneth Paltrow won, she was awarded $1. And then they interviewed one of the jurors, and one of the jurors said that when they listened to what Gwyneth Paltrow had to say, she had her truth. And then when they listened to what the optometrist had to say, he wasn't lying. He had his truth. And they as a jury pool had to decide which truth they wanted to align with. But I'm telling you, living in an absurd world,
yeah.
I don't get it. But somehow they managed to come to a conclusion, which is mind-boggling. And that's what this is. It's just mind-bogglingly absurd.
But now you can at least recognize it.
It's also making a virtue out of failure. Because
yeah.
if you succeed, you're supporting the status quo.
Yeah.
Their perspective. Person. 12.
That's just that's feeding into the system. They're the villains. Yeah, that's why you have to. That's why you have to be on your hippie commune and doing drugs, right?
Like the man.
Like
the machine. But you can't do it
confidently. Right.
Right. It passed the mission of we keep expanding the categories. Like it used to be the LGBTQ, and I'm sure
it's LGBTQIAP+.
Yeah,
now.
It just goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have anything to say? Yes, Chuck. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a difference between critical thinking and critical theory. So critical theory is all this stuff. That's not critical thinking. Yeah. Well, if you had noticed, there was one week that I had left out in there, and that was the week of religion. Neither of those two mentioned religion, because sometimes Marxists are pretty good at masking that they speak in religious language. But sometimes they're not good at that. And so I didn't know if I was going to get to this, and so I didn't write it for you, but we do have slides about it. I'm just going to read straight through it. You know, maybe you're not going to understand all of it, but you can get a flavor that sometimes Marxists do know that they're religious. So on the eve of Easter, let's read through this. In committing themselves to the oppressed, so this is talking about the people that, the elites, the liberals, the old school liberals in his day, which is the 1970s. So in committing themselves to the oppressed, they begin a new period of apprenticeship. This is not, however, to say that their commitment to the oppressed is thereby finally sealed. It will be severely tested during the course of this new apprenticeship when confronted in a more serious and profound way than ever before with the hazardous nature of existence. To pass such a test is not easy. This new apprenticeship will break down the elitist concept of existence they had absorbed while being ideologized. The sine qua non the apprenticeship demands is that, first of all, they really experience their own Easter, that they die as elitists so as to be resurrected on the side of the oppressed, that they be born again with the beings who are not allowed to be. Such a process implies a renunciation of myths that are dear to them, the myth of their superiority, of their purity of soul, of their virtues, their wisdom, the myth that they save the poor, the myth of the neutrality of the church, of theology, education, science, technology, the myth of their own impartiality. From these grow the other myths of the inferiority of other people, of their spiritual and physical impurity, and of the absolute ignorance of the oppressed. This Easter, which results in the changing of consciousness, must be existentially experienced. The real Easter is not commemorative rhetoric. It is praxis. It is historical movement. The old Easter of rhetoric is dead, with no hope of resurrection. It is only in the authenticity of historical praxis that Easter becomes the death that makes life possible. But the bourgeois worldview, basically necrophiliac or death-loving, and therefore static, is unable to accept the supremely biophiliac or life-loving experience of Easter. The bourgeois mentality, which is far more than just a convenient abstraction, kills the profound historical dynamism of Easter and turns it into no more than a date on the calendar. The lust to possess, a sign of necrophiliac worldview, rejects the deeper meaning of resurrection. Why should I be interested in rebirth if I hold in my hands, as objects to be possessed, the torn body and soul of the oppressed? I can only experience rebirth at the side of the oppressed by being born again, with them, in the process of liberation. I cannot turn such a rebirth into a means of owning the world, since it is essentially a means of transforming the world. Again, thus says the chief person who deals with pedagogical theory of our children, the real meaning of Easter. So yes, Marxism is a religion. It's a worldview, and hopefully we're now able to understand it a little more, to see it a little more, and maybe to get people out of it.
Two things before we close out. One is I'll probably end up getting in trouble